You are listening to The Raptor Report, the official podcast of Raptor Maps, the leading provider of lifecycle management software for the solar industry. This is Stephen Gloss, the lead Raptor reporter, joined by my co-host, Don Nista. We are here to highlight the latest trends and developments within the solar industry. Joining us today is Justin Wagg. Justin is the Director of Operational Readiness for Lightsource BP, a global leader in utility-scale solar and energy storage development and management. Thanks for taking part in this feature Raptor Report. Justin, how are you doing today?
I am well. Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. So let's get right to it, Justin. I'm pretty sure Don is well acquainted with you, but I'm perhaps not so much. So I'd love to learn a little bit more about your background, where you started, and how you got into the solar industry, into your position at Lightsource today.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess I'm an electrical engineer by trade, although I don't do a ton of engineering these days. I started in the solar industry as a residential rooftop designer back in 2010, almost 14 years to the day. And ever since then, I've kind of floated around in various engineering, project management, technical operations. And that's how I ended up here, sort of in this asset management and onboarding role here at Lightsource BP.
Yeah, it's awesome, Justin. I think some folks listening might know this, but I think you and I have worked together at three companies we've worked together at in the past? I think so.
Yeah, three companies, three states.
Three states, yeah. Engineers in Boulder, operations in North Carolina, and op/asset management in Florida. So definitely been part of the solar coaster together for a while. So as Stephen mentioned, we're quite well acquainted, but I think we still have a bunch of cool topics to go over today and a bunch of kind of insightful things to talk about with, for the listener. So yeah, let's jump right in. I have a background in operations and maintenance, so maybe let's start there because I'm always curious to hear like what's the latest trends and stuff. So, I know that you being in operational readiness kind of project handoff, like somewhat towards the end of the project life cycle. I'm curious, like what is the current trend you're seeing? Let's just go right into the hard hitting questions. What is the current trend you're seeing in like, O&M contract pricing? I know pre-COVID it was this race to the bottom and OPEX budgets have no money in them, and the place to find money is to squeeze your O&M provider and limit the scope and, you know, pressure them to downward movement on the pricing. What's kind of the latest you're seeing there market-wide? And yeah, I mean, you don't have to get very specific, but I'd like to know like trend-wise how you're feeling about it.
Yeah, no, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, Don, right? You know, pre-inflationary environment, there was definitely a race to the bottom amongst the industry and a lot of consolidation too. You know, what are we down to, maybe three to four sort of tier one suppliers domestically in the O&M field. But I don't know, I think I've seen a lot of changes in the T's and C's in these agreements. I mean, a big push probably to move away from a fixed price escalator, you know, in the 2 to 2.5% range. And a lot of folks are trying to tie it to CPI benchmarks, which is sort of a natural progression after we've seen the way the market has shifted in the past few years. And there's, you know, give and take there too. So I think we have a handful of agreements where we've allowed a CPI tie with a cap up to X percentage, things like that, which just seems to be kind of a fair play for both parties involved. And yeah, I mean, there's been changes to scope and sort of obviously with the IRA and some of the tax incentive agreements, there's certain liabilities that need to be borne by both parties. So a great example is the PTC projects these days where if we lose availability, we're kind of getting double dips, right? If for every megawatt hour lost, we're losing tax credits. So it's interesting, yeah, to see how the availability guarantees have changed over time and where the market's shifting. That being said, I think it's great that providers overall have matured a great deal, I would say, even from 5 years ago, in that I think we're getting better service and people are kind of sliding into their roles after we've, you know, had this huge shakeup in the market and the COVID environment, really. So
yeah, so if the O&M prices are starting to increase due to the, you know, just maybe the greater market pressures, not necessarily them just saying, oh, we want more money. I know that that doesn't mean that you have extra OPEX budget, right? That doesn't mean it's like, oh, let's just raise the OPEX budget in the financial model and everything's fine and you can pay for it. So how are you finding operational efficiencies and where are you finding that extra money to put into O&M where that's traditionally an area that's so squeezed?
Yeah. I think there's a handful of initiatives in the past couple of years since I kind of took on the O&M contracting here at Lightsource. And I think scope changes obviously is the first progression here and first stop, right? So a lot of the stuff that we've done is maybe pulling out sort of a lot of that manual VOC curve tracing sampling testing that is really labor intensive and honestly, you know, a debatable value add. And we've been replacing that with things like, you know, Raptor Maps IR scans. I think it's more valuable overall and it gives, you know, both parties alleviate some of the labor costs and I think provides a better work product. And then we don't have to hawk you guys. But I will say the other portion of this is vegetation management. I think historically, veg pricing has been a challenge nationwide. You know, you're building projects in Louisiana, the Carolinas, the growth rates are incredible. Labor costs and maintenance is super high for mowing. So Lightsource actually in the past, I don't know, year, 6 months, we've moved away from having our O&M provider offer vegetation management services as a base service. And we've gone out directly to the market with a lot of grazers. So if you look at the Lightsource marketing materials, it really isn't just a show. We've probably got 80% of our fleet right now being grazed in some form or fashion, whether partially or completely. And, you know, I'll admit I am an absolute convert. A year and a half ago, I thought, you know, this is not worth the headache and additional contracting and everything else associated with it. But I think, you know, baseline have reduced our vegetation management costs in the past year by about 40% year over year, just by moving away from O&M provider mowing and straight to, you know, project LLC contracting with grazers or mowers, you know, depending on what the market will bear. So that's been a wild success in Texas, Pennsylvania, the Midwest thus far for us. So I would look to that to continue to grow, honestly.
That's amazing, Justin. Actually, doing some research on Lightsource BP, if you just go to the website, which we'll share the link with our audience here with the information of this episode. But if you go to your website, you'll actually see like a little video stream playing in the background of, I guess it's just sheep or goats or whatever livestock grazing in the background of a solar farm. What does that effort look like when it comes to getting from, I guess, the ground zero to actually having a farmer there with an entire flock of animals grazing on a solar farm? Like how tedious is that process to get all those stars aligned?
Yeah, it's a good question, Stephen. I guess as far as Lightsource is concerned, we had a kind of a leg up in this particular market because of our presence in the UK and then their sort of propensity for grazing as well. So the precedent had already been set, which was useful. And then, you know, I will brag a little. We have a pretty fantastic environmental and diversity team here at Lightsource who does a lot of work with the ASGA, American Solar Grazing Association. They do a lot of like vendor vetting, basically, at the risk of, that's a pretty good pun actually. So yeah, they work directly with candidate grazers, whether they're, you know, sort of regional based or even potentially landowners who have a vested interest in the project. And we kind of can help to get them set up. That being said, we also have some kind of larger operations down in Texas that are more mature as well. But yeah, I mean, it's very much the same, Stephen, as you would do a normal O&M RFP. We go out to the market and solicit pricing based on a vegetation management plan that we provide to the prospective grazers. I will say, you know, a lot of these people are farmers and they're not the most sophisticated contracting counterparties. So we do have to kind of bring them along oftentimes. Some things like insurance requirements and the sort of wordy contract can be a little spooky for these folks. But overall, I would say it's been a, you know, resounding success thus far, you know, knocking on wood for sure. But there's just a lot of advantages and we're trying to take advantage of them for sure.
Are you able to find like regional or national groups that will connect you with a more local Like, is there like a contracting entity that you can do for like all of Texas? And then anywhere you have a site in Texas, they can connect you with a local farmer or somebody with a local flock? Or are you guys using your connections that you said your internal team connections to find like you able to do like a one-stop shop or a one state shop or a one region shop, or is it all piecemeal?
I think the answer is a bit of both. There's definitely some outfits that kind of specialize in solar grazing management, where they're sort of providing oversight and a backstop role. So our contracts are generally fixed height, sampled across a particular, you know, portion of the array. And I'm kind of like, to be honest, I'm agnostic to whether or not they use livestock or they mow it. So that oftentimes the solar, you know, veg manager kind of backstops that vegetation height guarantee. So if they need to come in and mow to supplement, like that's what they're there for. And they can help bring these sort of tenant farmers oftentimes up to more commercial standard. So there's a little of both, I would say. And then usually if we're going kind of straight to the barn with these contracts, then usually we'll start out on a smaller scale, a few hundred acres, because cutting a 1600, 2000 acre contract for someone who hasn't really done this yet is a risk that, we can't quite bear at least to start. So.
Yeah. Justin, how much progress has been made on coming down to like accurate pricing when it comes to vegetation management? Like, how accurate have the vegetation forecasting models been for larger sites and like areas like the Southeast where there's shrubs and swamps and things growing out at an outrageous pace? Were there initial like growing pains within the industry in those areas when it came to vegetation management, and how have those been reconciled over the past couple of years?
Yeah, it's another good one, Steven. I mean, I think it's funny. I'm very pleased to be in this role at LightSource that was sort of recognized as a need within the business. It's kind of unique. So I kind of view my role primarily as that feedback loop between operations all the way back out to sort of greenfield development. And as part of that, we generate a lot of OPEX forecasts for pipeline projects and make sure that we're kind of tuned in to historical costs and maybe some strategic decisions on future forecasting. So to your point about, are we budgeting accurately? I think historically there's been a lot of push and pull on, well, how many mows do we really need in a year? Can we get away with three in X region? Is it going to be five? What's the pricing? And I think, the truth is we're pretty lean in that portion of the budget for sure. Although it can have a really outsized impact on the project, right? I mean, not least of all, just from shading, but there's certain risks of default associated with the maintenance of the property. So yeah, it's been tough, I think, to come in under budget on a veg contract over the years, but I can say that LightSource has taken steps in the right direction for sure. And our asset management team, who went through and sort of renegotiated all these O&M agreements and carved out the veg scope, huge win for the whole portfolio that we've got, in the ground today. So
have you guys had, this is something I didn't even think of until literally just now, but have you guys had any situations where the flock has gotten to site like before the EPC either turned over care, custody, and control or demobilized? Like, is there any EPC that's like, wait a minute, like going to cost us a ton to do this during construction? Why don't you just get those animals out here now?
Yeah, I think we've done that pretty ad hoc. On occasion, we have a phase turnover, right? So we've got 300 plus megawatt project. We'll turn over phase 1, 2, 3 over time. And in that case, we've done a lot of that stuff where we'll roll out sort of a prorated version of the veg contract, mostly because they don't have care, custody, and control of those phases anymore. And then, we have a good support system for our construction folks. So if they need a mow like on short order and EPCs unwilling or unable in the short term to do it, then we can certainly mobilize people like in a hurry if we need to. Yeah, we have very strong partners, I would say, and we do a good job of supporting the other verticals within the business, definitely.
Nice. I know like with part of your role and being involved in handover, and I'm assuming you're pretty upstream, like you don't just wait until COD to start paying attention to the site. So this is something that is near and dear to my heart, and I'm so glad to hear that you guys are approaching it the way you are. But I wanted to ask about you being kind of Mr. Site Handoff and transition to O&M. I know from previous conversations with you that you've moved up your O&M provider's presence on site, whereas historically it's been like, I don't want to say COD, but like there's been, or commercial operation date or place in service, but there's been this like, okay, O&M comes on and we give them the keys and care, custody, and control when everything's, you know, minted and humming and beautiful, and we'll just hand it off and then everything's going to work right, right? I know from previous conversations with you that you guys have kind of moved that schedule up. Maybe talk a bit about how you guys are approaching handoff with O&M providers and what changes you've made and how it's worked out.
Yeah, yeah. I think the short answer is that, you know, the sooner we can get the O&M provider out on site, the better, right? I mean, that overlap and interface with the construction team and just familiarizing yourself with the site, it's pretty invaluable. Just to understand, yeah, you know, I think you used the phrase where the bodies are buried. That obviously there's nothing quite that egregious usually, but it's good to get them out. So we've moved out to 60 days pre-SC is sort of the target date now. That's kind of a recent rollout this summer and springtime. And that just, that scope is sort of a pre-start commissioning scope where they're supporting the construction team and whatever may or may not be happening day to day, doing site walkdowns, you know, outside of just an initial inspection, they're helping to inform the punch list and make, you know, decisions around quality. So yeah, I really view those guys as our eyes and ears out in the field, and we're kind of on the same, we're definitely on the same team with the same goals of turning over a safe, compliant, and quality site. So that there's a ton of value add there, I think, in just getting them out sooner. And then a lot of what we've done lately is turning over care, custody, and control of the substation work once it's complete immediately to the O&M provider. So, you know, with the lead times on transformers and medium voltage, high voltage equipment being out in the 24, 36 week lead time range, our substations have been finishing, you know, largely hitting substantial completion, sometimes months in advance of the PV plant. So we'll turn the sub over to our O&M providers. They can perform switching scope during capacity and availability testing. They've got eyes on it from their rocks, and they've just got a lot more experience and savvy sort of operating these plants that oftentimes our EPC partners, still tier one, don't necessarily have the infrastructure set up to maintain and operate those for that period of time. So that's been super valuable too, and it works the kinks out in sort of our PPC and SCADA control portion, which is always sort of the final hurdle for project turnover, is can we operate this thing remotely, and are all the bells and whistles, you know, playing along. So that's the way we've moved, and I kind of look to even draw that out further. I think in the future I would imagine we'll start moving towards a 90 day or even beyond if we can make the project economics work.
It's just, I'm curious, I know that especially the COVID impact of the supply chain was a big hurdle when it came to getting turnover completed and getting these sites fully functional. Is that still the case today? And if not, or if perhaps maybe there's a competing obstacle now?
No, I mean, I think you're right, Stephen. In large part, like, those supply chains are, I don't know, they're still pretty protracted compared to, I don't know, 10 years ago, probably. But I think that speaks to the volume that we're putting in the ground too these days. And sort of the niche nature of this equipment, right? So where I see it most here in the project turnover part of this is, you know, I'm not super involved at procurement stage oftentimes, but we do solicit and store a good number of spare parts, whether that's, you know, MVTs, substation breakers, and basically single point of failure equipment. And I'm trying to get out further in front of that spare parts issue, because, you know, we'll hit operations, but the lead time on this breaker or, you know, overhead switch is 36 weeks, and I've been operating for 3 months, and I'm still not going to see it till January type situation. So that's my main focus in a lot of ways, has been to try and move the spare parts review and procurement out further, closer to, you know, financial close or like NTP for the projects, so that when we hit operation, we've got that relay that can go bad, that can take a whole plant, you know, 150 megawatts off for weeks on end, that we've got that ready to go. So it's interesting to have to be that sort of like far-sighted these days. I think it's certainly exacerbated after the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, I've been down that road with, and I'm so glad to know that this is becoming standard with some more serious investment in spares. And in some places, I know some of the larger companies are literally building spare part depots on some of their sites and kind of getting way out ahead of procuring things that might be hard to find in the future. So it's kind of awesome to see that that's made its way into your budgets and kind of made its way into the operational readiness, as you guys call it in your role. So that's definitely super cool to hear. I want to know, like, and maybe this is kind of going to be a ridiculous question, but how are you, like, is a follow-up spare parts question, I guess. How are you approaching like some of the more extreme spare parts, or like even all the way up to like GSUs and stuff, like the kind of the super long lead time spare parts that, you know, if that goes down, it's obviously mission critical, or maybe not all the way to GSU. You don't have to, if you don't have an answer for that, then maybe down to like inverter spares or whole inverters or whole transformers. Has it gone to that level, or is it still stuff that can fit in an average Connex?
It's a fair question, one that, you know, everybody has probably chewed on for years now. Honestly, we can't make project economics work storing a GSU, you know, with the oil drained in a warehouse somewhere. But a lot of what we've done is on the design phase too. I think we've tried to consolidate our, you know, interconnection configurations across the board. So when we do have something go down, there's a chance we can borrow from other plants or something that's already sort of like in process being ordered. And then, yeah, I mean, spare parts as a concept certainly is always well received, but it's hard to quantify the project economics, right? So that's really where the issue comes, because you're trying to say, oh, well, if we didn't have this, we'd have been down X or Y days, but that device has a fixed cost where it's sort of depreciating in a Connex in a field somewhere. It's tough. It's certainly tough. I think I would love to see spare parts as a service a little more, where we could sort of put together, I don't know, a community of spare parts holders and trade off between projects. That obviously raises issues with the financing deals and who owns what. Yeah, I know. It's an interesting question that I think Lightsource is still kind of wrestling with themselves. I know we've made a substantial investment in spare parts that are held outside of the project companies, and then we can sort of bring things back to life a lot sooner. But it's tough. You know, what do you stock? Where do you store it? To your point, Don, like, does it make sense to leave a very expensive piece of equipment in a soggy field in a Connex in the Carolinas? Like, it's tough to say, right? That part of the business has some growing to do, I think.
Yeah, Justin, I'm curious. I'm not sure how well these are correlated together, but which would you say is under more pressure when it comes to supply chain issues? Would it be the construction component when it comes to construction monitoring and the actual building of a solar site, or the operations phase where a site's actually up and running? Who's under more pressure when it comes to getting equipment in that they need?
I would say it varies, honestly, Stephen. That there's some very obvious pain points, right, for the construction folks, where they are soliciting proposals for very specific GSUs that have incredibly long lead times, and you got to get in the queue and wait a year and a half to get something delivered. That is obviously problematic for them. Where they do have a leg up on the operations team is in their procurement agreements, right? So we've got, you know, multi-hundred megawatt supply agreements, safe harbored equipment, owner supplied, that really helps alleviate some of the PV plant equipment. But us on the O&M side, right, we inherit, who knows, 1% modules as spares. And then if we were to need to solicit another proposal for new modules, hey, Texas has a bunch of hail, we don't have enough modules on site to replace what we do need, then it puts us in a tough spot, right? We don't have necessarily the buying power as our procurement arm does. Now, we can leverage them, certainly, but turning something around that quick is also, you know, it's a tough sell a lot of times on the operation side.
Well, since you said the H word, I'm going to just transition us right into that. It's become a bad word in the industry. So, and it's front of mind right now because the storms have been pretty active down in the southern US. So, and the H word I'm talking about, of course, is hail. So I know from my past and from talking to you and maybe cheating off BP a little bit, I've built out some hail readiness plans in my past, but how does BP approach that? I mean, we were just talking spares. Obviously you can try to put spares, you can try to get spares, but you know, when a hail event happens, it can be a pretty high amount of panels, which can be hard to justify putting in spare. So how do you guys kind of approach preparedness for that? And I know there's some clever things that you guys have done maybe ahead of a lot of the industry, and maybe some the industry as a whole might be kind of copying your playbook. So how do you guys approach it?
Yeah. I won't claim to be the brainchild of this, but BP has a light source here, has a pretty comprehensive hail mitigation strategy. I think to your point about storing spares, right, there's not really a scenario where we're ever going to store enough to supplement a really, truly bad hail event. So the idea from light source here is mitigation, right? And our policy is called Project Whiskey Ball. I think the synopsis is sort of it's a one button stow option. It comes with a lot of our single axis trackers. So ATI, Next Tracker, you know, you name it, generally speaking, can accommodate. And the idea is we monitor active storms with respect to our fleet as it's distributed across the US. And then we can issue a proactive stow order, which basically tips the modules at, what is it, plus or minus 60 for Next Tracker, 55 for ATI, something like that, with the intent being to minimize sort of a direct strike from a hailstorm. Obviously, sometimes we stow and hail doesn't happen, but when we really truly need it, it's certainly a net benefit to the project. And part of that Project Whiskey Ball strategy has sort of been to supplement the service with our O&M providers, right? And I think there's a lot of tier one suppliers here in the US that are coming around on this. It raises some liability and sort of indemnity questions about who owns what in the event of damage or whatnot. But it's been an overall success, I would say. I mean, the storms in Texas here, I think I can't imagine that everybody got out of that unscathed. And all we can really do is kind of plan for the best and mitigate as best we can.
Yeah, this is getting back a little bit to basics here, Justin, but I'm curious, on the O&M side, do you guys exercise some sort of like akin to a fire drill, like sort of doing like a mock test of the responsiveness of these strategies, like the one button stow option? Is that something that's being tested on a regular basis? And how are you ensuring that the equipment is readily equipped to go into that stow mode when needed?
Yeah, no, I mean, much the same as sort of like our SCADA commissioning and plant testing overall. We'll go through a, you know, hail stow mitigation drill essentially, and we'll activate the one button stow, and then we can watch in our monitoring platform to see stow rate, current angle of the array, and see if there's any sort of issues. You know, Next Tracker being kind of distributed, you could have a table here or there that's not following commands. At least then you can get, you know, a tech out there to maybe stow that one manually as needed. But yeah, there's absolutely sort of some drills associated with it to make sure that we can stow in time. There's definitely a give and take on when do we stow, you know, what's our threshold. It's an interesting program. It's pretty, I would say, manual, you know, in its current incarnation, which is why, you know, our O&M providers are certainly offering it as a service. But yeah. It's a good question, Stephen. I mean, we certainly need to make sure it's working properly before we sell this as a service or as an offering that we provide. So,
yeah, I guess my concern is like equipment that's been sitting out. You know, we talk about climate being, you know, a sort of a stressor on these systems, you know, in a really extreme heat and muggy climate. You know, how can you ensure that the farm is going to respond the way that it needs to in those situations, I guess, is the main concern.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I do like to rag on putting equipment out in a soggy field. I mean, granted, normally we put the equipment out in the soggy field and it's not even in a Connex. So like, to be fair, it should be fine in most cases. But yeah, the ongoing maintenance for our plant certainly covers, I think, most of the operation around Whiskey Ball as well. So as long as we're, you know, completing our OEM required maintenance on the trackers and performing periodic testing and staying on top of tracker tables that may be down or, you know, not tracking correctly, then generally speaking, I think we've had success there. Yeah. DC health is always something that's kind of tough definitely takes a lower priority, I think, in a lot of businesses because it's always a constant effort in triage. So if we've got a tracker table down, we're not going to fix that first, right? We're going to go fix an inverter outage. So it's something that's tough to stay on top of for sure.
You mentioned that's a somewhat manual process right now. I know you guys don't have a, you know, you're subbing out your O&M, right? So are those weather alerts or hail alarms coming into BP and then somebody's manually calling or emailing the your O&M control centers to say, hey, we have concern of a storm in the area, please place it in stow? Or are those alerts being forwarded directly into your O&M control centers? How does it flow?
I think the answer is it depends. When Whiskey Ball sort of was conceived, it was a fully supported offering on our side. So our O&M oversight team is basically monitoring storm activity every morning to log in and check and see what the forecast is here, there, and everywhere. And then if there is, you know, risk thereof of a hailstorm, we were proactively reaching out to our O&M providers and issuing a stow order. I know not everywhere has sort of this level of additional oversight internally. So there have been conversations that I've had with our O&M providers across the spectrum about what they're willing to offer as a service, you know, not supported by Lightsource. And I think some are more sophisticated than others. You know, they may have this infrastructure already in place proactively, and others I think are getting up to speed still. So there's a cost associated with it, certainly. And again, that's a tough one to quantify, right? So is it worth X dollars a year to prevent, you know, possible Y damage in the year? You know, it's really hard to sell a lot of times, but I think if we see a handful more here of like real substantive insurance claims, that the market is going to come around in a hurry, I think. And that speaks to insurance rates nationwide, right? You know, wildfire danger and natural disaster overall, insurance rates have had a lot of upward pressure here recently.
Yeah, it's been tricky. I know from my past that some of those inflated insurance rates or increasing insurance rates, whatever you want to call it, have in a lot of cases killed the project financials, and basically the project finance model blows up and you in some areas literally can't even build the site because of the insurance hikes that we've seen. I wanted to ask you and maybe you've seen it, maybe you haven't, but very recently one of the module OEMs came out with I don't know what the name they're calling it, but it's essentially I don't want to say hail proof, but it's a panel that can withstand significantly more hail than what the current design spec is for like dime or quarter size, and they're promoting their new product as like pool cue size or pool ball size. Did you see this article come out? And just maybe general question, do you think hearing what you guys are doing seems to me like as much as you could possibly do on the op side, like get some spares and then prepare for hail, you know, put the panels in stow. I've gone deep into this and I just don't know what else we can do as like owners and operators. So I've always kind of thought maybe the next step is on the OEMs. Like, have you seen this product and like, do you think that maybe that's the solution is like an OEM thing? We need to design thicker glass, stronger panels.
I haven't actually seen this. It's tough to say though. I think, Don, like, you know, procurement costs drive the market. Steel prices fluctuating can make or break a project month over month, you know, during the development phase. But it's tough to say whether or not a project economics can bear additional cost for, you know, more robust modules or not. I mean, what's really going to need to happen is, you know, a lot of the proactive steps that we're taking to mitigate this stuff, we're going to have to see some return on insurance rates, and the market is just not there yet, right? So if we install a fire break around the plant, is there, you know, a corresponding reduction in the rate in the insurance rates? If we install this type of module, does that mean that our rates go down again, or are they up with a different type, thin film or something? That's really, if we're not making up ground in other parts of the model, then it's tough to justify it today, you know, as a pure OpEx add or a CapEx add.
Yeah, I think what's going to have to happen until we have enough like real world data from these, you know, new hail proof panels, is the panel manufacturers, the OEMs, are going to have to put a guarantee in place that the insurers believe in, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of put your money where your mouth is. If these panels are really hail proof, guarantee it, and then we'll lower the insurance rates, and then everybody, you know, is happy because the extra money they spent on these more robust panels is being made up, like you said, on the insurance side. And until there's enough real world data, the insurers aren't going to do that. So maybe the answer right now is a guarantee or a warranty from the OEMs that the insurers believe in. So,
yeah,
I don't know if there was a question buried in there, but
no. I mean, it raises an interesting thought too, because a lot of what we've been dealing with sort of in the maintenance side for years is sort of pretty loose warranty terms. So whether that's modules, you know, specific to hail, or whether that's response times in an inverter manufacturer, it's really tough to drive, you know, repairs and maintenance with sort of toothless warranty terms. And that's not, you know, unique to any one company here within the industry, but we've got a pretty concerted effort to try and add some availability guarantees and some added service around warranties specific to inverters, modules is probably the next natural progression, honestly.
Yeah, Justin, we hear more and more, and we're seeing the data. It's really exciting. The solar industry is growing; it just keeps scaling almost at an exponential rate. Is this perhaps solar's biggest concern, like the potential Achilles heel here, is insurance, bad weather, or what is it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a loaded question, Stephen. How long do you have here? So I think just climate change in general, I think we've seen the effects of that. And, you know, obviously that leads directly to changes in insurance rates. So we've got, you know, issues with wildfires in PG&E, California territory. They're issuing proactive outages, which directly affects revenues on operating plants. I mean, how do we forecast a reliability outage in CAISO or something when we're getting more aggressive or more conservative, I suppose, in regards to them during, you know, high wind events and things like that? It's really tough. It's tough on project economics. Like, forecasting revenue is the other backside of this, right? I mean, we can really dial in our operations costs, but if our revenue is variable because we're taking outages or damage, it's tough. It's certainly. Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. I try not to dabble too much in revenue. I'm more the wrench turning, like, operations guy for the most part. Try to keep my guardrails up on that one.
Love it.
Sweet. So I wanted to ask, this is something me and Steven had chatted about, and I know it's something that BP puts out there in the world. So I'm curious, what does Light Source BP's, like, community first approach look like? Like, what is that? How is that actualized? Like, what does that mean, I guess, first? And then what do you guys actually do to promote that?
It's a good one. I'll admit, we have the advantage of having a strong community relations team. I think a lot of where that goodwill, community goodwill is made is in the development phase. I mean, we really need to be good partners with our local landowners, local communities. So, you know, great example there is including landowners as part of the grazing program. That's, you know, from a purely operator standpoint, can create some entanglements, right? If we have a rent payment due to a landowner, but they're not performing on a contract, it's definitely tough to navigate. But yeah, I think everyone has a vested interest, particularly the neighbors in these projects. And so including them in some form or fashion in the development and the operation has borne a lot of goodwill for us historically, whether that's, you know, having local high schools out to explain the solar sort of plants to them and barbecue for the fire department to make sure they understand how to react if there was an incident on site, things like that. That stuff all goes a long way. And I think Light Source is very forward thinking in that regard, and that, you know, we can't develop more projects in the region if we are burning bridges during development. So.
Yeah, I know it's critical. I mean, a lot of times, you know, developer of your size or developer owner operator or developer owner, I don't know how you guys IPP, you guys are looking at the next project always, right? It's not just like get this done, make our money and move on. So you guys are like, wait, we want to be here, be part of these communities and potentially build the next project down the road. So that stewardship and kind of like playing well with your neighbor has to be critical to your guys' like long-term success. So yeah, I think you know, I really appreciate your time, Justin. I wanted to give you the opportunity if there's anything else you wanted to say or just kind of tell the people if they wanted to reach out to you. I'm assuming LinkedIn's the best place to find you, and if they want to learn more about LightSource BP, I'm assuming there's a URL we can drop in the info. But if there's anything else you wanted to say before we kind of wrap things up, here's your opportunity.
No, I don't think so, guys. I appreciate the time for sure. I mean, we could talk all day about anything and everything solar at this point. But yeah, hit me up on LinkedIn if anybody wants to talk about LightSource or the programs that we're sort of managing these days. And, you know, I'm always happy to share notes on OPEX reductions and performance optimization and quality controls. Like, let's talk about it for sure.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Justin. And thank you, the listener, to listening to this episode of The Raptor Report. We hope we've been able to provide you with some enlightening insights that have sparked your curiosity and increased your awareness of developments within the solar industry. Look out for new episodes on your favorite podcasting platform, where you'll get to have the chance to hear insights about solar from unique perspectives and leaders within the solar industry. Until then, this is Stephen Gloss and
Don Nista
signing off.